This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the CCWG Accountability Workstream 2 Jurisdiction Subgroup Meeting, number 18, on January 24th, 2017 at 1300 UTC. Would like to record that we have apologies from Jorge Concio and Caboose Arasta for today's call. Caboose is going for a medical checkup on his injured hand or wrist. So hope that all works out well for Caboose. Is there anybody who is on audio only?
Yes, Greg, this is Nacho Bay speaking, and I will be joining the AC room shortly.
Thank you, Matthew. Anybody with updates to their statements of interest? I'll take it we have no updates to statements of interest. So let us begin. We'll begin trying to round out the discussion of our, how we'll get our questionnaire out there.
Hi, it's Becky Burr.
Hi, Becky, welcome. Ms. Becky is on audio only, so we'll add her to the roll call. So, in the last call, we discussed a variety of options for getting the questionnaire out there, and discussion took place on the list as well. It seems to me, looking at the options, that overall, it seemed to be the most supported option, although there was not a lot of discussion from too many people. Was to announce it on the ICANN public comments page and then have that announcement go to a page on which the questionnaire was available, and that it would be publicized through all the usual ICANN methods, and that in addition, of course, it can be publicized by each of us through any organization of which we're participants. Are there any thoughts or concerns or alternatives for that approach? Seeing no objections and noting affirmation from David McCauley in the chat, that seems to have been the general conclusion. I think we can confirm that conclusion, that we will, assuming that ICANN has no objection, publish it on the public comments page, have that lead to a page on which the questionnaire is available, and then publicize it through usual ICANN channels and any channels that participants here want to publicize it through, since it's intended to go beyond the SOACs and the usual suspects for answering such questionnaires. Next question is the time period for responses to the questionnaire. There we had a number of options, and I see a hand from Matthew Vaya, who has now joined the Adobe. Matthew?
Thanks, Greg. Just a quick synchronization item we had with staff earlier. It appears that we should be ready to go out to launch the questionnaire basically between 8 or 10th of February, and that should be the sufficient to get the translations in. So if we apply the 42-day standard period, that's 15 days, that ends on March 24th, something like this, which is 15 days after the IAC and Copenhagen meeting. And I think as a starting point for issuing the questionnaire, that would be probably very appropriate, give everyone time to discuss in Copenhagen, go back, submit a response. And if there was a need to extend at that point, then we would have to consider it after Copenhagen. But I think as a starting point, it's good to rely on good practice, and we could work on the 42-day standard period starting around February 8 or 10th. Thank you.
Thank you, Mathieu. That seems like a sensible approach to me, but I will take comments, of course, from the participants in this call. So, David McCauley.
Thanks, Greg, and thanks to Mathieu for that information. I think one thing that we should look to, much like we're standing up this small group to look at litigation, is that we should have, you know, we should be preparing to look at answers to the questionnaire during the period that the questionnaire is open, because there's, you know, that hiatus between it being announced and being closed doesn't stop us from looking at things as they come in the interim, because it'll just keep us, help to keep us on track. And so we may want to create teams for that as well, too. Thank you.
Thank you, David. That's a good suggestion. We, of course, want to look at all responses equally. I'm not favor early arrivals, but certainly in terms of we shouldn't wait necessarily till the end. And so how we plot this, as Mathieu notes, this is a fact-finding exercise, so we'll look at the facts as we receive them. So I think that's a good idea, and we'll do that. We don't need to do that yet, but we will make sure that we are ready for the onslaught of submissions. So I think that covers the time period question. Then move on to the translation question. It seems now translation has been built into our plan and to launch all at once with translations into the usual ICANN languages. Any comments on the translation issue or on waiting to put it out with the translation so it comes out simultaneously? David, is that a new hand?
It is, Greg. It's David McCauley for the record. So I think you just answered my question, and that is that we will be translating into the standard ICANN languages. Is that true? And I was I recall that there were several there was at least one, but maybe more volunteers to translate into languages beyond those standard languages. And I had a comment on that. But if we're not going beyond, then I don't have a comment.
Well, there was one participant, and I think may have been supported by another participant, who suggested the questionnaire be translated into Farsi. But it was clarified that they were not volunteering to translate it themselves. Rather, they were asking that it be translated into Farsi. So that's the only translation issue or that I saw raised on the list. And have not explored how we would deal with translation beyond the standard languages. Don't know how I can deals with that if it does. I don't know, David, if that then triggers your hand.
Well, thank you, Greg. David McCauley again. Before we go down that path very far, I would like to make a comment. I'll try and keep it brief. First of all, the participant that made the volunteer was, as I recall, Farzani, and I thought that that was a very noble and welcome idea, but I would urge caution in this respect for a couple of reasons. One is there's, you know, there are standard ICANN languages, there are standard UN languages for a reason, that they seem to be efficient coverage of the globe, you know, for all practical purposes. I recognize it's not perfect. But if we were to translate beyond those, you know, putting a question in a language is an invitation to people to respond in that language. And I would suggest that we need to have a plan in place and to sort of have some idea of budgetary impact to know that we can handle that. Otherwise, it would be unfair, I think. And so my caution would be to stick with the standard languages, make sure we have budget for that, but stick with the standard languages unless we sort of formally address this and understand what it involves. Another issue with this is why some languages and not others. It's fraught with certain concerns. The instinct behind it is very noble. I'm not being critical, and I certainly don't want to impede people's ability to hear these questions and to answer them, but I just think we have other considerations that we also need to attend to just to make sure we're on proper ground. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, David. Cheryl?
Thanks, Greg. Cheryl, for the record. David, your points are well taken, and my concern on volunteer translation is what I wanted to raise, but I also wanted to point out that language services, the professional group in language services within ICANN that operates very effectively, very efficiently, and has a network that they can access well beyond our standard UN languages, does provide ICANN on request, not only from time to time, but in the case of some of the at-large work, quite frequently, additional languages to the UN. For example, within the at-large community, it is almost expected, for an example, that we do the 6 UN languages and Portuguese. That happens to meet the needs of the requests that come in from the community at the current time. Now, as community need changes, so do those requests. You're right, there is the, if you put it out in language X, the probability of getting answers back in language X is high, so proper planning is required, and that's one of the reasons I am always an advocate of sticking with the professional language services provision. Having individuals well-meaningly offer to make local language copy of material which is of a nature of outreach is a different situation, and that's something that I'm quite supportive of, particularly within the Asia Pacific area where we have huge numbers of languages to deal with should we decide to not choose to work as we do choose to work primarily with English. That said, if we believe that putting out in any of the languages, because recognising, you know, if we put it out in the 6 UN languages, and I support that we do so, we're also inviting to get them back in the 6 UN languages. So there is going to be the reverse translation issues regardless of the, I'm going to use the term risk in inverted commas there. So it does have to be considered, does have to be planned for. It takes some time and a little money, but if we stick within the gambit of that's an expectation for language services to deal with as well, then they're prepared, we're prepared, and we can operate within an ICANN-based plan. So I have absolutely no problem should we decide to support the request for FASI as well. But should we do so, and I'm very supportive of doing that, I think we have to stick with it as a planned operation, which includes, as it would for any of the languages, the likelihood of us having to bring a language questionnaire back from whatever language it's supplied to us in, back as a copy that will be a comparative master copy for use in English as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Turn to Aubrey Dorian.
Aubrey speaking. Quickly, I unless there's really a specific reason why we need for the professional translation to go beyond the six, and I guess I missed, I'd be supportive of translating it into whatever, but I don't actually know why specifically one needs to add more languages at this point. I think that if it's going out as part of the official, it needs to be done by the professional outfit, as explained. I do, however, see if somebody does want to translate it as part of their, you know, this group encourages them to pass it out into all their networks, all the relevant networks. If they want to translate it informally in terms of passing it on to their network, I see no problem in it as long as there's an expectation that this group is dealing with responses in one of the six languages that is. So we could have an asymmetry between the number of languages that people read the question in because there were informal translations and the number of responses that are translated that are only translated in the ones that professional services are providing services for. So I can see us having that asymmetry. I don't think it's a bad thing for people to translate something that they want to push into their network, but I do think we have to take a care with making sure that if the responses are within the formal set of languages. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. I don't think there's anything we could do to stop people from translating it into any language they wish and distributing it themselves. But I think that, you know, Cheryl points out, and I think you did as well, that, you know, for an official ICANN output even of this, we would want to go with, you know, professional translators. So, and I agree that in terms of responses, we need to get them back in languages that that we can have translated efficiently and authoritatively. So that would be my view. And I note too that if one looks at the, you know, distribution of languages in the world, and of course the six UN languages plus Portuguese don't necessarily aren't necessarily the top six, though they're close-ish. You know, we run into Hindi, Bengali, Punjabi, Javanese, Malay, Telugu, others, Wu, Vietnamese, Korean, Marathi, Tamil, Urdu, Turkish, etc. And I'm sorry if I did not get to a language which you speak before I stopped, but the point is, even at that point, we're still talking about over 50, 70 million speakers or so, 63 million. So in any case, it kind of, you know, gets us into a bit of a slippery slope, but again, if somebody wants to distribute it themselves, I was just reading off Wikipedia. I'm not encyclopedic myself. And therefore, you know, footnote. So it seems to me that just to take a temperature of the room, that in terms of the formal output, I guess Aubrey's been watching the young Pope asking when we'll do the formal liturgical Latin translation. I'm also hoping to have it translated into Hebrew and Yiddish for that matter. Let's just take a temperature of the room and see the general support or objections to having the output of the that goes on the ICANN page be the seven ICANN languages. Give me a check if you support that. And an X if you object to that for any reason. Yeah, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 checks and no X's. Let's clear those checks, and after clearing the checks, we'd just like to ask if there is anyone who supports going beyond the ICANN languages and seeking additional professional translation to be placed on the ICANN page. If you support this, please give me a green check. If you do not support or object, give me a red X, please. I see one red X, no green checks, so there does not seem to be support for that. So we will translate it then into the ICANN languages. And again, no objection if anybody informally translates it for their own network or own use, but responses will need to be in the ICANN languages. I think that takes care of that issue. Any other comments or questions or concerns on the questionnaire before we move on to other items? Seeing none, we'll move on to item 3 on the agenda, the small group review of ICANN's past and current litigation. As discussed in last call and on this, on the list leading up to this call, we've asked for a small group to review the roughly 35 litigation, I think one of them is an arbitration, that are posted on ICANN's litigation page, which is, the link is at 3A in your agenda. So far, I believe the volunteers that we have for this are David McCauley, Cavus Araste, Phil Corwin, Aubrey Doria, Doa Shendi, Mathieu Bay, Adebunmi Akinbo, Greg Shatton, and I believe Eric Schweighofer as well. Eric, if you could confirm that in the chat, that would be helpful. I have prepared a suggestion for a draft summary form, which is posted as a Google Doc This is just to get the small group started, and they can, or we can, work on it further. And I've also created a sign-up sheet, which is also up as a Google Doc. I've sent PDFs of both of those along. Let's put up the summary form in the Adobe room and just see if there are any comments here. We have our first volunteer as well, volunteering for the State Attorneys General versus the NTIA, U.S. Department of Commerce, Penny Pritzker and Lawrence E. Strickland, the volunteer of Matthew Vey. Here is the summary page. See if there are any suggestions here on whether there are other items that should be recorded. Obviously, there are other items that can be derived from it. For instance, the date the case began and the date the case ended, we can derive the length of the case from that piece, those two pieces of information. The size of the field is not intended to be a limitation. Fields can be as long as they need to be, but we should not be too prolix. It's just how it displays here. Matthew.
Thanks, Greg. I think all the informations here are relevant. I actually have a question on the one on the bottom, the influences of jurisdiction. It may be a little ambiguous. Maybe we'll need to clarify exactly what we expect in this part of the summary, because it may not be perfectly obvious to fit in. Could you expand what you're expecting on that part of the summary of any of the cases?
Thank you, Matthew. I agree that is the one item here which cannot be derived kind of in a purely kind of factual necessarily or derived from the documents without any judgment by the case summarizer. But the intent there was to see what, if any, way the jurisdiction, and by that I would refer to all the multiple layers of jurisdiction, but essentially what was the if there was any influence on the case and how it proceeded because of the jurisdiction in which it took place, or which I think would be the, we're looking really at the court and venue and the choice of law, governing law, question. So for instance, a case could be in taking place in a California court applying Dutch law, and it could be that because Dutch law was applied, a particular standard or cause of action was allowed. I guess the question is how do we relate the summaries and the cases to our work, and to see what way there was a relationship between litigation and the ability to either carry on the dispute or settle the dispute. So that's my thinking, and it's a little bit unformed, but I think that if we think about how we want to derive value from these summaries, I think we'll need some sort of analysis. I think David Macaulay suggests the question, was jurisdiction contested in any manner? And I think that's a fair question. I don't think that necessarily replaces the relevance to our work. And perhaps that's as good a way to phrase it, taking that from Matthew Shears, rather than influences of jurisdiction, which is both ambiguous and somewhat, provocative. So I would suggest the following two changes to this. One is to ask, was jurisdiction contested? And also relevance of the case to our work. So any further comments or suggestions on that? Matthew, a comment in the chat. Our influence doc has three categories we could map to cases. Influence on operation of ICANN policies, ICANN accountability mechanisms, and disputes involving ICANN. I think there are all going to be disputes involving ICANN on this list. But I think for the other two, I think that makes sense to tag it to those items, influence on accountability mechanisms and influence on operation of ICANN policies, because that really is the mandate of the group to look at those aspects of jurisdiction. So we could add that as a tagging item. Any comments on this? Farzana asks, are we going to discuss arbitration cases, too, if there are any? There is one reported arbitration on the ICANN list, but that would be summarized. I don't think we are going to summarize IRP cases, however, or UDRP cases. Or you know, other cases where ICANN is not a party. So I think we're sticking with the 35 cases, which include at least one arbitration that are on the list. So I think that covers this. Any comments on the summary sheet? If we could... hearing no comments, I think we can go back to the agenda, and I'll change the summary sheet according to the discussion. I would encourage everyone who has volunteered for the small group to go to the sign-up sheet and sign up themselves for the cases that they wish to summarize. The links in the summary form should be live, so you should be able to go directly from the summary form to the case that you've chosen, so you could start right away. I think one other question was raised and then raised again, which is the time scale for this effort. There are 35 cases, and we now have 9 volunteers. If one were to assume an equal distribution, that's roughly 4 cases per person. I'm thinking 3 weeks should be ample for at least get the summaries done. Any comments on whether that's too much time, not enough time? Seeing one okay from David McCauley, who's in the group. Bernie Turcotte, hand is up.
Just find it easier when putting action items in the notes if you actually pick a date for when you mean 3 weeks.
Good point. So let's see, today is the 24th, so why don't we say 3 weeks would be the 14th of February, so why don't we say the 14th of February then? Okay. So I think that covers the litigation project. So and let's see. Obviously, the group should communicate amongst themselves and should see whether this is a workable timeline or not. Not trying to be a slave driver. In any case, let's move on to the influences of ICANN's existing jurisdiction document, which we have not looked at in a while. And if we could put that up in the chat, or rather in the Adobe Connect room, and go to Section C of that document. So I think you all have scroll control. The reason that I suggest going to Section C, even though there's quite a bit before that, is that the first couple of sections really go over the kind of the layers of jurisdiction. I would like to get to rather than issues about the layers of jurisdiction, issues about jurisdiction itself that have been raised, and see if we can actually start discussing those. And there have been some suggested, so hopefully we have looked at them, but if not, we can be in here with E1 A on the bottom of page 3. And I think that in terms of reviewing suggested issues or problems, you know, we'll need to consider whether this is actual or hypothetical, the likelihood that it could occur under what circumstances, and whether it's relevant to our mandate, whether it seems like an accurate statement of the question, and of course the substance of the question itself, and how the question relates to accountability and operation of policies or settlement resolution of disputes. So the first postulated question is that a U.S. court may find ICANN's actions involving actual operations of its policies, like delegation of a GTLD, and or acceptance of certain terms of registry operations to be in derogation of U.S. law and instruct it to change its actions. So there are a number of comments after that in the document itself, which I'll admit I wrote. The initial Section A was written by Plominder. So I'd like to see if there are any comments on this issue, whether this is in fact an issue or just a feature of jurisdiction, whether there are problems that arise from this, as arise from that relate, as this question does, to operation of policy. or to accountability. Any comments on this? Bernie, I don't know if that's a new hand. We have a hand from David McCauley. David.
Great, thanks, David McCauley again. I just have a question, and I will admit that I have not been in this document in a while. And so are we also to compare, you know, like what would happen elsewhere, or is this just a question about the U.S.? And when do we – I'm just trying to get a context for what we're doing here. Thank you.
Thank you, David. That's a good question. I think we'll need to refine our working method as we determine how to look at the issues, as whether we generate them within the group and put them into this document or other documents, whether we receive them from the questionnaire. So I think it is, you know, certainly a valid comment. That this is would be a feature of any jurisdiction in which ICANN could find itself, may or may not be subject to U.S. law in addition to other laws. I think it's a fair question right now that could be posed that we could go to. I think it's. In terms of how we proceed, I think it's something that could be brought up in the initial analysis of the potential concern or issue, or for that matter, positive influence. If the reason the word influence was chosen is that it is not a positive or a negative word. So there are both potentially advantages or disadvantages. Any other questions or comments on this particular hypothetical? I phrase it as a hypothetical because it is phrased as a hypothetical. I did ask, have there been any such cases in the past that hasn't been answered yet? So... David McCauley comments in the chat. I think it is a good comment on my comment, Greg. This asks us to wonder about the future when we have past performance to judge by. Why not go by that? I'll just read my comment on this hypothetical and why I find it a little bit inaccurate or at least incomplete, which is that U.S. courts don't act on their own initiative. They only act if there's a case that's been brought. There has to be a plaintiff who believes they've been injured or that they represent a class of injured persons or entities and that they have a cause of action to bring a case. And then that dispute is heard by the court, hearing from both parties, attorneys and witnesses and also, you know, potentially from third parties through amicus briefs or intervention or otherwise. And then ultimately the case will be resolved by the court or it, may, of course, might be settled by the party. I think at the heart of this is that there is some law that is being violated, or at least that the plaintiff believes there is a law that has been violated, or that there is a breach of contract, which itself, you know, is a tort, which is a violation of law, or that ICANN has violated its bylaws. So there's a problem at the heart of this. So the question is it a problem that people can go to court in the U.S., which is the current jurisdiction, but not the only jurisdiction where ICANN can be sued, to resolve that problem. any comments on this? I would love to hear other people's thoughts, since this is kind of, in many ways, the heart of the kind of work that we need to be doing. So please don't be shy.
Can I get in the queue, Greg?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yes, this is Mathieu speaking. My suggestion would be, because your point is really good, that we make sure we phrase these items that say something like, a court might do this or that, in the way you just mentioned, which is a plaintiff may go to a court seeking for an injunction or a decision with this or that. I think that would be more accurate, and it's also going to help us when we look at the actual cases and the feedback we get from the questionnaires. It will help us identify in which type of case we are in the various cases we'll be reviewing. So I think that would be my way of moving forward with the comments you're making. Thank you.
Thank you, Mathieu. I think that's a very good suggestion. I'll take a hand from David McCauley next.
Thanks, Greg. David McCauley here. You just made a comment that I think prompts me to make this comment, and that is you said that ICANN can be sued in the United States and the other countries where, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but the other places where it has offices. One thing that might be useful for us at some point is to ask a legal question of our outside counselors to speak about norms of jurisdiction. I believe they're changing in the digital age, whereas it used to be that some presence was required for jurisdiction. Now that there's economic impacts that can be visited over the Internet, I think there's a lot of nations that may be looking at targeted actions as opposed to presence. And so I think it's possible that the answer to the question on where ICANN can be sued is actually much larger than where it simply has offices. And I think that would be helpful. I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it would be helpful to have maybe some legal advice along that point at some point. This isn't urgent, but, you know, we'll be working for the next couple of months. Maybe it'd be nice to hear about that going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I think that's a good suggestion, and perhaps if I could trouble you to put that out on the list as a suggestion, a potential question for our outside counsel, then we can refer that email to the legal committee for review as to whether we would authorize the question. But I think, you know, certainly if we could all, you know, be more knowledgeable about where ICANN, or for that matter, any party can be sued, and knowing that there are things such as long-arm jurisdiction and other ways to reach folks and hail them into court, I think it's worth understanding. And thank you, David. I can see you probably have other things to do other than this, but I appreciate that you will do that. Any other comments on this hypothetical? Anyone who believes this is, you know, with Mathieu's amendment, if you will, in terms of identifying the act, the initial actor, more accurately. Anyone who has comments on whether this is a problem, isn't a problem, how we should analyze it. I'll just go on for a moment then and note that, you know, I've asked, you know, with regard to the two specific examples that are given, delegation of a GTLD or acceptance of a registry, of acceptance of certain terms of registry operation, whether this, you know, who is the plaintiff in this case, whose rights are being, who's feeling that they've been injured, and what law is actually being violated here. So I think it's important to try to identify those things in any hypothetical as well, especially because that goes to the issue of how likely it is that it could, in fact, be realistic as a hypothetical. And then I've also asked, and I can ask that question to the group, in what way would this be a positive, negative, or neutral influence on operation of ICANN's policy? Any thoughts on that? I'll advance my own thought. We should be thinking along these lines. To my mind, this is a positive influence in that it goes to keeping ICANN accountable. One way that any party is kept accountable is that they can be sued, and that if someone experiences an injury or believes they've experienced an injury due to that party's actions or inactions, that they have redress and recourse to the courts. Additional recourse and redress to things like arbitration, such as IRP, and other internal recourse is also good, of course, but those are not necessarily equivalent, and as we've noted extensively in the Workstream 1, these may still need to be enforced in court as well, even if we get a ruling in an IRP. So my first comment is that this is a positive influence on the operation of ICANN's policies. I don't know if there's an implication in the question being asked, but there's also a negative influence on the operation of ICANN's policies as well. Would appreciate anybody's thoughts on that, or even neutral influences, if you will. Hearing nothing further, the next question that I asked there was, have there been any cases in the past? I think it is important to see if we're dealing with things that are truly hypothetical, or if we have any actual activities that fall into these categories. Any comments? Since we only have 4 minutes left, I don't think it makes sense to get into the second hypothetical that's here. But I'd like to help understand, if I could, this is an important aspect of our work, and I realize that people may not have read this hypothetical or had a chance to really reflect on it before, but I'm hopeful that we can have more robust discussions about these issues. It's essentially this kind of issue, or one can think of it as the gap analysis, which we need to go back to defining exactly what that gap analysis is. I'd like to understand how we can have robust discussions about this that can involve folks, regardless of their background or whether they have the legal training for better or worse. David?
Craig, thanks. I will admit that I'm one of those who have been, you know, as we focused on the questionnaire and then the legal review, I have not been back to this document in a bit. So I think you raise a good point. This is an important document. There's a lot of comments in it. Some people, like myself, may struggle with Google Docs, but we have to sort of get through that. So my suggestion would be that, you know, if we're going to discuss this in the next week, in 2 weeks or whatever it might be, is that even before the agenda, you know, you might put out a short email saying, now we are turning to this document. It's got a lot in it, so here's a week's notice that it'll be on next week's agenda. And that'll give folks some time to get back into it. It's just a suggestion. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, David. I think I'd take that suggestion a step further even and extract a question or questions that we're going to discuss and put them into the agenda or into a document or email text that's sent along well before the agenda to kind of tee things up. And so that there are, for those who aren't getting into Google Docs or having issues with Google Docs, that we have kind of a very specific assignment, if you will. So I will do that. And that way we can also get the discussion started on the list as well. So that I realize it's a bit of jumping into the deep end of the pool to just, you know, flip to this question halfway through our call and ask people to comment on it cold. So I think that teeing up questions, making it clear what we're going to be discussing, giving people time to formulate their thoughts and to ask questions and engage in some discussion on a list beforehand, I think will either result in issues being wrapped up on the list more or less, or at least more fruitful discussions on the calls. So I think that's a good amendment to our or detail to our working method. So it now being 8:59, I'll just see if there's any other business from anybody. Well, seeing no other business, I will thank you all for attending. I will thank those who volunteered for the litigation summary project. Ask them to go sign up on the list, and I will publicize the issues to be discussed on the next call well in advance, so that we can discuss them with as much preparation as possible. So I thank you all again. This meeting is now adjourned. We can turn off the recording. Goodbye and have a good day, evening, or night.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks, everybody. Everyone.
Bye.